Hello, and welcome to Science World. With the Winter Olympics about to begin, there's a new study that examines the effect a warmer world has had on past and will have on future Winter Games. We'll learn about the role St. Louis, Missouri played in boosting aviation in the 1920s and spaceflight in the 1990s. And today we'll hear from a Canadian researcher whose study on human psychology has revealed that nightmares pack a greater emotional punch. These stories and more are coming up for you on VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. The success of the upcoming Winter Olympic Games will depend a lot on the weather. Roseanne Skirbel tells us about a new study that examines the effect a warmer world has had on past and will have on future Winter Games.
Daniel Scott analyzed weather conditions for all 19 cities that have hosted the Winter Olympics since the Games began in 1924. The University of Waterloo environmental researcher wanted to answer this question.
Are the current internationally known winter sports destinations, are they suitable, climatically suitable, to continue to host the Winter Games as we move into an era of climate change?
Scott says, according to his analysis of historic records and climate models, all 19 could host the Games again in the near future.
But what we found is by mid-century, under the climate change scenarios that we looked at, that number had dropped from 19 being climate reliable down to about 10 or 11, depending on the climate change scenario. And then by the end of the century, that number dropped to as low as 6 under the warmest scenario.
The Winter Games require weather cold enough to make snow and sustain a snowpack. Beginning in the 1980s, host cities began taking measures to ensure that. They made artificial snow and built refrigerated tracks for luge and bobsled. High-resolution weather forecasts also helped in day-to-day operations. But the planet has been warming since the 1950s as more carbon emissions from cars, power plants, and buildings spew into the atmosphere. Just a week before the 2010 Games, Vancouver was hit by a warm front.
Washed away the good snowpack that they had in January in North Vancouver, and it was too warm to make snow, so they had to bring in the straw bales. They put what limited snow they could over top of those, and that was just sufficient to do some of the moguls and some of the other types of events that were scheduled there.
Some question whether Sochi, a seaside town, will fare any better. It's the warmest city ever to host the Winter Olympics, with an average temperature of 10 degrees Celsius. Outdoor events are scheduled many kilometers away. Scott's report recommends that the International Olympic Committee consider new venues like northern China, which has the elevation for downhill ski events, and new partnerships.
So it might have to be, you know, a future, maybe a Seattle and a Salt Lake City rebid or something like that, where you have a main Olympic venue, a bigger city that can accommodate the size that the Olympics has grown to, but there'll be a sort of secondary location with a smaller part of the Games that has all of the skiing events, and it is located in a much more climate-reliable location.
Scott says while his report highlights the challenges that lie ahead for Olympic athletes, it also underscores the decline in areas suitable for any winter sports enthusiast in a warmer world, unless dramatic steps are taken to reduce climate-changing emissions. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
For nearly a century, entrepreneurs in St. Louis, Missouri have reached for the sky. First, it was Charles Lindbergh's transatlantic flight in the 1920s, and then in 1996, the XPRIZE led to the world's first private reusable manned spacecraft. Shelley Schlender reports.
St. Louis entrepreneur Greg Marionak enjoys spending time at this mid-sized airport, watching the single-engine planes rumble into the sky. He says that airplanes similar to these and a book about them ignited his passion for making dreams fly.
I read The Spirit of St. Louis, and within a year I was taking flying lessons. I was one of those kids that would spend all the money I would make pushing lawnmowers and doing various other odd jobs to pay for an hour of dual instruction in a plane about half the size of the one behind us.
The book that supercharged Marionak's ambition is about Charles Lindbergh. In 1927, the lanky young pilot entered a contest that promised $25,000 to the first person to fly nonstop from New York to Paris. Many pilots had died attempting the 5,800-kilometer flight. Lindbergh's lack of connection with prestigious aviation efforts led journalists to call him the flying fool. But financial backers from St. Louis believed in him. In their honor, Lindbergh named his plane the Spirit of St. Louis and won the prize.
He made it. Charles A. Lindbergh, Lucky Lindy as they call him, landed at Le Bourget Airport, Paris at 5:24 this afternoon.
Greg Marianek says Lindbergh's success opened the door for modern aviation.
Within a year of Lindbergh's flight in 1927, the number of pilots in America triples, the number of airplanes quadruples, and the number of people buying tickets to go on commercial flights goes up 30-fold.
That $25,000 prize was a surprisingly small investment to spawn today's $500 billion aviation industry. And Marianek plays a big part in a futuristic wing of that industry. In the early 1990s, he and his friend, entrepreneur Peter Diamandis, proposed a new contest to inspire private companies to develop better planes for space.
Everybody knew, quote unquote, that only NASA and the Russians, at the time we announced the prize, could send people to space. We knew that wasn't true. In fact, we'd been stymied by people's belief that only governments could do this. We really wanted to change that.
For startup funds, Marianek headed where Lindbergh had 70 years earlier, St. Louis.
I think in most cities we would have been launched into space by toe of people's boots, but not here in St. Louis. We'd got the initial seed money that allowed us to start the foundation.
The XPRIZE Foundation's mission is to create public competitions designed to kickstart technologies that benefit mankind. In 1996, the head of NASA and 20 astronauts joined Peter Diamandis as he stood beside St. Louis's landmark of soaring ambition, the 200-meter-high Gateway Arch, and issued a challenge.
This $10 million award will be going to the winner, which is the first team to do the following: to privately build a spaceship, privately finance that ship, a ship that's able to fly to 100 kilometers altitude, carry three individuals, and do that twice inside of 2 weeks.
More than two dozen national and international teams entered that first XPRIZE competition. The Scale Composites Company won, with a plane named Spaceship One.
Unofficially, we've got an apogee call of 368,000 feet.
Since then, many companies have designed better ways to fly people and cargo into space. Other XPRIZEs have spurred innovations ranging from more fuel-efficient cars to oil spill cleanups. A current prize challenges entrepreneurs to put robots on the moon. For VOA News, I'm Shelley Schlender in St. Louis.
It's time once again for the Science World Quick Quiz. We just heard about the XPRIZE and the contest that inspired this modern competition. For completing his historic nonstop New York to Paris flight in 1927, Charles Lindbergh won a contest with a $25,000 prize. What was the name of that contest? Was it A, the Wright Brothers Medal, B, the Polaris Award, C, the Orteg Prize, or D, the Sikorsky Prize? Good luck. We'll give you the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
Listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine.
Unless you're African, your skin may carry traces of your Neanderthal forebears. According to new research, our ancient human ancestors acquired some skin genes that helped them survive outside Africa by mating with Neanderthals. Steve Barragona has more.
When humans wandered out of Africa and into Europe and Asia, our closest hominid relatives, the Neanderthals, already had been there for a few hundred thousand years, says genetics graduate student Benjamin Verneau at the University of Washington.
So, of course, there's always been the possibility that they would have met and that they would have interbred, but there hasn't been evidence for that. And we finally got evidence in 2010.
That 2010 discovery found that non-Africans inherit about 1 to 3% of their DNA from Neanderthals. The next question was, which 1-3%? Freneau and his colleagues went looking through the genomes of 665 people for statistical patterns that would identify Neanderthal genes.
It turns out that those genes tend to be expressed in what are called keratinocytes, so basically in the skin.
Several genes dealing with a protein called keratin, found in skin, hair, and fingernails, trace back to Neanderthals in more than 60% of those studied. The findings are published in two scientific journals, Science and Nature. Freneau says those Neanderthal genes must have helped our ancestors adapt to the environment outside Africa, but they don't know exactly how.
We know that two of the genes are associated with pigmentation, so it could be that we inherited lighter skin from Neanderthals, but as I said, it's really difficult to pin that down.
University of California at Berkeley geneticist Montgomery Slatkin was not involved with this research, but he was one of the scientists who sequenced the Neanderthal genome. He says the findings are important.
These two papers provide the first evidence that genes from Neanderthals affected modern humans in an important way. They were favored by natural selection.
The scientists also found parts of the genome in which Neanderthal genes must not have been favored. Almost no Neanderthal genes were found in parts of the genome dealing with fertility, for example. And that makes sense, because humans and Neanderthals were different species. And Harvard University geneticist Sriram Shankararaman says offspring of this kind of mixed marriage would be a hybrid. He spoke by Skype.
These hybrids tend to be less fit, or they are less fertile, or sometimes sterile.
For example, horses and donkeys can mate, but they produce mules, which are sterile. And the genes that cause infertility do not survive. Researchers also found Neanderthal genes in parts of the genome linked with a number of ailments, including diabetes, lupus, Crohn's disease, and smoking behavior.
There, the interpretation is not very clear at all.
Shankararaman says researchers don't know if those genes raise or lower the risk of disease.
Again, it doesn't mean that the Neanderthal allele is causing a certain disease or a certain phenotype. It's just associated with that.
So if you can't stop smoking, don't blame the Neanderthals. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
New York City and the state of New York have developed a concept called incubators, providing fully equipped, subsidized workspaces for qualified startup companies. Bernard Schussman reports from a biotech incubator in New York City.
Harlem Biospace is the first city-backed incubator facility for biomedical engineering. It gives young entrepreneurs a relatively low-cost way to develop their ideas and businesses. A low monthly fee provides them with desk space and laboratory facilities. They pay for their own raw materials.
This is great. The reason is because it's cheap and it has the wet lab that we need. So I order the chemicals that I need, and I'm given the facilities here to do my experiments.
Tyler Poor and his partner are developing a product that will kill bacteria forever. It can be applied to household items like a sponge or to anything that needs to be bacteria-free. His goal and that of the 17 others at Biospace is to find solutions to biomedical problems. Edwin Vasquez is looking to unlock the mystery of diseases, such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. He says feedback from others in the building makes the work environment at Biospace a real plus.
And there's nothing better than sit down in a room like this when there's a lot more people around and, you know, you got something that is exciting and you go to the lunchroom and you start talking to other of your colleagues, you know, and all of a sudden somebody knows that you... Somebody knows a researcher that is doing something similar to you or that can complement your research, you get in contact and things happen.
Leading hospitals and science centers are supporting innovators like Kate Rocklin, founder of a company called Immunovet. She has developed a new allergy diagnostic which uses a brush applied to the nose or mouth instead of a needle.
And it's actually as accurate or more accurate than skin or blood testing. And from one single sample from the nose or mouth, we can test for a whole panel of 72 allergens. And we found that the blood test identified peanut allergies only 50% of the time, and we could find it 99% of the time. So we're far more accurate for peanut diagnosis, and that's really important because that one in particular is really life-threatening.
$600,000 from the city of New York got this project underway. According to Biospace Executive Director Matthew Owens, there have been real signs of success since last November's start.
We do have companies who are already shipping, getting revenue and getting products out to customers. So I think that's absolutely a success.
The primary goal of an incubator is to develop a business that can operate independently and become financially viable. The Harlem Biospace Incubator, with its cutting-edge research, is offering that opportunity. Bernard Chessman, VOA News, New York.
Well, do you think you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz? Let's find out. A few minutes ago, we asked what was the name of the contest that awarded a $25,000 prize to Charles Lindbergh in 1927 for completing his historic nonstop New York to Paris flight. Was it A, the Wright Brothers Medal, B, the Polaris Award, C, the Orteg Prize, or D, the Sikorsky Prize? The answer for today's quick quiz is C, the Orteg Prize. Back in 1919, Raymond Orteg, who owned a hotel in New York, issued a challenge to aviators. In his challenge, which was originally issued in a letter to the Aero Club of America, Mr. Orteg offered a prize of $25,000 to the first aviator of any Allied country crossing the Atlantic in one flight from Paris to New York or New York to Paris. It wasn't until Saturday, May 22, 1927, when a mostly unknown Charles Lindbergh, flying in his airplane named the Spirit of St. Louis, touched down at Le Bourget Airport in Paris and won the $25,000 prize. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
Waking up after having a nice dream will put a smile on your face and will help get your day off to a good start. But a terrifying nightmare can wake you up out of a sound sleep, leaving you scared and confused. A new study released by researchers in Canada has revealed that nightmares indeed have a greater emotional impact than simply having a bad dream. The study was conducted at the University of Montreal by psychology researchers Genevieve Robert and Antonio Zadra. Dr. Zadra joins us for this week's one-on-one segment to talk about the research he and his colleague conducted on bad dreams and nightmares. Are there differences between bad dreams and nightmares?
Yes, actually, there are, and it's one that can be best understood in terms of intensity. Nightmares are really disturbing dreams that awakens the sleeper. So usually we wake up startled, relieved that the experience was just a dream, and the awakening can be tied in directly to what was going on in the nightmare. Bad dreams are also highly disturbing, but we tend to remember them later on in the day or when we wake up with an external device like the alarm clock. So there's no temporal relation between the content of the dream and us waking up from it in the case of bad dreams.
You found that nightmares have more of an emotional impact than bad dreams. How so?
The nightmares end up giving rise to added distress than bad dreams do. And also when we ask people to rate the intensity of emotions that they experience within the dreams, nightmares come out as being much more emotionally intense than do bad dreams overall. And bad dreams, of course, are much more intense than your everyday mundane dream experience.
When I think about having a nightmare or a bad dream, one emotion I mostly think of is fear. What other emotions are played on by these dreams?
Well, one finding, which is might be quite surprising to people, is that about 35% of all nightmares and over half of bad dreams contain primary emotions other than fear. And these can be sadness, guilt, confusion, anger. So nightmares can intensify a broad range of negative emotions, although fear does remain the primary one.
What do most people have nightmares or bad dreams about? I understand that you and your colleague analyzed plenty of nightmares and bad dreams. So is there a general theme?
Yes, if we look at what are the most common themes, and we examined close to 10,000 dream narratives that people collected in the course of our study. And so one of the most frequently reported themes involves physical aggressions, also interpersonal conflicts where the person is having an intense argument or is being humiliated by either a coworker or a family member, things of that nature. Themes related to failure or helplessness, health-related concerns, being told, for instance, that you are about to die because you have cancer or learning of someone's death, and themes that most people might think about as being your typical nightmare, because that is what is often shown in novels and movies. The theme of being chased is actually relatively rare, occurring about 10% of nightmares and about 5% of all bad dreams. And then you have others. You can have the presence of evil forces, accidents, disasters, which, whether it's a flood, war, insects, things of that nature.
Are there differences in these dreams between gender and age groups?
One fascinating thing is that, yes, there are significant differences between the nightmares of men and women. So whereas themes relating to disasters and calamities are much more common in men's nightmares than women, so these would be dreams of floods, earthquakes, wars, end of the world, those kinds of scenarios. Whereas nightmares involving interpersonal conflicts are twice as frequently reported by women in their nightmares. And again, these are often centered around conflicts with coworkers, family members, spouse, friends, things of that nature.
Whenever I see literature about interpreting dreams, there's symbolism involved. What role does symbolism play in these dreams?
Well, one thing that is quite fascinating is that whereas everyday dreams really can cover a wide, broad spectrum of different contents, as the dream becomes more and more intense, the themes it represents gets more restricted. And so we see a more restricted range of themes in bad dreams, and this range becomes even further restricted in nightmares, such that most of these highly negative and intense dreams involve threats to survival, security, or self-esteem.
Professor, when we usually think of dreams, both good and bad, we think of it as a kind of a cinema of the mind while we're asleep, more of a visual experience. Could other senses or feelings be used to manifest a bad dream or nightmare?
Absolutely. And so, as you correctly point out, most dreams are inherently visual, but they're also auditory. We hear people scream, talk to us. We can hear a sirens or a dog barking, things of that nature. But in rare instances, we can also feel physical pain. We can have tactile sensations. We can feel the cold or warmth around us. And we can also have sensations in about 1% of dreams of either tasting things or olfactory sensations. For instance, walking into a bakery and being able to smell the wonderful aromas from that fresh bread or croissant coming out of the baker's oven.
I know you've probably been asked this question a number of times, but why do we have bad dreams or nightmares? Is it physically based on such things as eating a heavy meal before bedtime, or emotionally based, such as having a guilty conscience or perhaps an unidentified fear?
I think we can probably put to rest the idea that having the pepperoni pizza before going to bed induces nightmares. The heavy meal and so on, what it might do is cause us to have indigestion, might cause us to wake up during the night, and thus maybe more likely to remember a dream that we would have otherwise forgotten. But by and large, many nightmares tend to occur in periods where people are under stress, whether this is work-related, whether people are undergoing inner relationship issues, financial circumstances. So in periods of stress or where we doubt ourselves, where we feel insecure, tend to be the periods where nightmares are more likely to occur. That being said, having the occasional nightmare appears to be a universal experience, and thus that in and of itself is not something unusual or something to be worried about.
That was Dr. Antonio Zadra, a psychologist and professor with the Department of Psychology at Canada's University of Montreal. That's it for this edition of Science World. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.